Hey people, I gotta take a second to tell you about something we do around here called the THC Money Bomb. What I do is every 5 episodes, I total up the donations I've gotten in that period of time, and half keeps me and the show going. I take the other half and I gift that back to a random listener. So far we're hitting about 500 each round and I couldn't be happier about it. So consider throwing in 5 or 10 bucks. It's cheaper than a hand at the blackjack table with better odds than a scratch-off ticket. Plus, you know half supports a show you like, and at the very least, half will go to a like-minded person who could probably use a nice surprise in these troubled times. When you make a donation, I can see your email address, and that's how I pick the winner. But to keep things kosher, you can also get in the pool by sending your info on a postcard to me, Greg Carlwood, P.O. Box 635223, San Diego, California, 92163. I got no subscription fees here, no paid archives, no paid bonus shows, and I want to keep it that way, on principle. But I'm not a millionaire at the podcast on the side. This is it for me. And I'm the only one I know who's trying to help the people out as well.
That's my man!
So help me help you. If you want to play along, go to thehiresidechats.com/donate and get in the game. Dollars, bitcoins, it's all good to me. And that's what we call the THC Money Bomb. Boom.
In the 1930s, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of fire. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Fireside Chats.
How's it going, Ironside Chatters? Drink a little drink, smoking copious amounts of smoke. I'm Greg Carlwood from sunny San Diego. The show's coming out a little late this week. I apologize, but my job has been a real hell lately that I think could only be summed up appropriately by these words from Jerry Maguire.
It is an up at dawn, pride-swallowing siege that I will never fully tell you about, okay?
But honestly, guys, if I'm being honest with you, I've been so focused on this show that I've really put my job on the back burner. I've kind of been office spacing it, but they're on to me, and I'm really close to getting fired. So I've had to kind of switch the focus up a little bit, but I guess we're just going to have to see what happens. It's scary, but that's also my goddamn dream come true. And all the donations and support is really making me feel like I could probably get by. And I have some amazing ideas on what I would do with my time. I'd go out to places like the CSETI Ranch and film some clips for you guys. Stuff that can be trusted. Stuff where I won't just shit on everything that seems a little out there. Like some people have done. It would be a beautiful thing, but it's a stressful time, so bear with me, people. That said, real quick, I'm going to play our category from the Stitcher Awards this weekend. Check it out.
So let's get to the awards. Oh, the first one is Best Science and Medicine. And a lot of people don't know this. I had a little science podcast before I did Grammar Girl because I was a science writer. So I listened to all these shows. So the nominees are Skeptoid with Brian Dunning. Woo! Star Talk with Neil deGrasse Tyson. Yeah! Science Friday. Yeah. Stuff to Blow Your Mind. Quirks and Quarks from CBC Radio. And the Higher Side Chats. And the winner is... And the winner is Star Talk!
So we didn't win, but that's okay. Just getting another nomination this year is what's important. It's just another bullet point I can include on my interview requests. Makes us look legit. And a quick update on the Money Bomb. We're only on episode 92. This round just started. We're at $370. Wow. Thank you so goddamn much. We've gotten several people putting in 30, 40, 50 bucks, including the last Money Bomb winner. He put 50 bucks back in. What a cool guy. So yes, it seems like I'm going to be giving away well over $200 if it keeps building the way it's building. So, all right, then. Today's show is on a theory called Earth crust displacement. I found it fascinating. It might account for a lot of the unknowns of antiquity. And we talked a lot about Plato and the legend of Atlantis. Rand was a great dude, awesome guest, very convincing. I'm going to let you hear about my t-shirt brand conspiracies real quick. And then we're going to talk to Rand Flemoth.
We're here because we don't buy into the bullshit of mainstream culture. We're tired of the mundane, passionless careers we've been shuffled into as a result of this orchestrated debt-based system of rule, and the stranglehold on education and entertainment by cold, soulless corporations. People, yes, we are frustrated. Yes, we are tired. And we reject the pre-approved tranquilizers that are Monday Night Football and an ice-cold Budweiser. But we have to stop hiding. Stop hiding behind the headphones and the Cherry Popper 420 username. Let the world see that the resistance is strong and society is changing. There was a time to be anonymous, but that time has passed. And so the Higher Side Chats would like to present conspiracies as the dawning of this new paradigm in the uniform of the revolution. Because bold fashion should mean more than some celebrity meat dresser frat boy in a silly pink polo. Conspiracies redefines bold fashion as having the balls to reject socially uncomfortable and unpopular truths from your radiant chest all fucking day. Conspiracies.net. Let them know that you know. Bold designs for troubled times. Hard truths. Soft talk.
All right, people. As we know, there's an arrogant tendency to think that we have a handle on the planet Earth, yet it's been said that we know less about our own oceans than we do about space. We're constantly discovering new species in the depths of our thickest jungles and ancient ruins and structures that spit in the face of the popular opinion that traditional academia considers dogmatic fact. Well, today we're going to challenge one of those paradigms in the realm of geography and our understanding of the ancient past, and today's guest is here to make the case for Earth crust displacement and the idea that Atlantis very well may have been on the land we now call Antarctica when it was once in a place with a more tropical climate. His name is Rand Flemoth, and he's the author of three books entitled When the Sky Fell in Search of Atlantis, The Atlantis Blueprint, Unlocking the Ancient Mysteries of a Long-Lost Civilization, and most recently, Atlantis Beneath the Ice, The Fate of the Lost Continent. It's a pleasure to have him here, the number one stunner. Rand, welcome to THC.
Oh, thank you very much, Greg. It's great to be here.
Yeah, man, this is going to be awesome. I've always loved the stories of Atlantis and the mystery and the lore that surround it. Clearly you have as well, since you've written so much about it. Let's start with some of the fun stuff. Most people know the story of Atlantis comes from Plato, but what else can you tell us about the origins of this information of an advanced culture in the distant past?
Well, Plato actually is the first person to record the story of Atlantis. He didn't actually, he himself says he did not originate it. However, as far as we are concerned today, some 2,400 years later, it all goes down to Plato. But Plato himself, in the story, the dialogue that he talks about Atlantis, there's two of them actually, he mentions that his ancestor, Solon, who lived some 200 years before him, Solon was the founder of Athenian democracy. And he, after having established democracy in a very loose sense, no, women didn't have the vote, but men did have the vote, and the aristocrats didn't control everything, which was the first time in history that that had happened. And Solon was responsible for that. But he found that everybody was asking him to intercede on their problems. So he decided just to up and skip out of Athens, and he went on a wisdom quest. And the first place he went to, of course, was Egypt, because that's where everything was happening. And when he got there, he met with some of the Egyptian priests, and in one particular priest he met with, his name was Zonkus, was very knowledgeable about Egyptian history, had all the written records, and so to try to get him to speak, Solon, what he did was he started to talk about the flood what the Greeks knew about the flood, and Zonkus interrupted him and said, "Oh, Solon, Solon, you Greeks are but children. You have no idea of the past. But I'm going to tell you, because I have the written records from a lost civilization 9,000 years ago. And this was taking place around 600 BC, this conversation. And I can tell you about this this island continent in the middle of the real ocean. He called it the Atlantic Ocean, but he also called it the real ocean. Now, we have to understand what Atlantic meant to the Greeks. To the Greeks, they viewed the world as a disk on water. There was three geographic sections. There was Europe, Libya, which was like Africa, North Africa, and Asia, which we would call the Middle East, probably. And to the west of there's the Strait of Gibraltar, which they called the Pillars of Hercules. And beyond the Pillars of Hercules was, you just didn't go there because nobody came back when they went out there. So, but the ocean that was out there was called the Atlantic, but it also included that Atlantic Ocean went all the way around the Earth disk in the Greek worldview. Mm-hmm. So it was to the west, north, east, and south. So it was a completely world-circling ocean called the Atlantic. As time went by and the Europeans started to explore the world, the meaning of the term Atlantic was changed to refer to the body of water between Europe and America and Africa and South America, and no longer referred to the far north or the far south or the far east. So the term Atlantic changed. So when we're talking about what Plato records Solon hearing from Zonkas, we have to bear in mind that what Zonkas is referring to is an ocean that circles the world.
Okay.
And he calls it the Atlantic Ocean, but he also calls it the real ocean. And he says, compared to the Mediterranean is but a bay to this world ocean. And so in the course of my investigations, I came across a map of the world. This is on our website at Atlantis in Antarctica, where the world is depicted from Antarctica. And what it looks like is very much like a dartboard. In the middle is Antarctica. Then there's this big ocean that goes all the way around it, which includes the Atlantic, the Indian, the Pacific Ocean, all the oceans, as a single unit. And then the rest of the continent seem to encircle the world ocean. When you're looking at the world from Antarctica, it's very different from our European concept. But what we're saying in Atlantis Beneath the Ice is that Plato's description of what Zonkas, the Egyptian priest, told Solon refers to a real ocean, and that perspective that he gives is an accurate, extremely accurate description of the entire Earth's geography as seen from Antarctica. And that is like just straightforward an explanation of why people haven't understood the Plato's account of Atlantis, is because they've always been fixated that the Atlantic meant the North Atlantic, when in reality, as far as the Greeks were concerned, the Atlantic and the real ocean, and what oceanographers call the world ocean, because in reality, our planet only has one ocean. If you look at Antarctica at a globe and you ask yourself what ocean it's in, you'd have to say that it's both in the South Atlantic, the Indian, South Indian, and the South Pacific.
Right,
but in reality, there's no division between those bodies of water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're just kind of arbitrary, imaginary lines made by humans.
There were historical ways in which the Europeans took a grip on the world's geography. So when Magellan made it through the Straits of Magellan between South America and Antarctica and got, and it was so treacherous, it was absolutely treacherous. He barely made it through there. He was the first to go around the world. And when he got to the Pacific, he called it the Peaceful Ocean. That's why we call it the Pacific Ocean. Vasco da Gama, when he got to India by going around South America, called that the Indian Ocean. So what you're having here is that the Atlantic Ocean of the Greeks' time get subdivided up by the European explorers, and we end up with several oceans, when in reality, as oceanographers will tell you, there is but one ocean, and it's a continuous body of water. And compared to it, the Mediterranean is but a bay with a narrow entrance. And that is actually in the description that Zonkas gives to Solon. So what Zonkas is describing is how the world looks like from Atlantis. And in that description, it's an accurate depiction of what the U.S. Naval Support Force drew a map of Antarctica at the center, and that when you compare that map to what Plato said, then everything that has been a mystery for 2,500 years is suddenly resolved, because all of the things that he says in that make sense once you understand Atlantis and Antarctica are the same.
Man, that's fascinating stuff, man. Well, let's talk a little bit about the society of Atlantis. What have the writings told us about what the society structure might have been like?
Well, it was a constitutional monarchy. There was 10 provinces or states, but if you like, each of them had their own leader. Each of them weren't elected. They were it was hereditary kings of each of the provinces. We don't know a lot. What Plato records is what Zonkas told Solon, and what Zonkas told Solon was that this was an extremely advanced engineering civilization with massive megalithic projects that would dwarf the pyramids. Things like massive canals, the buildings that are described in the city of Atlantis, because there, Atlantis refers not only to the continent, the island continent of Atlantis, but it also refers to the capital, which is Atlantis. It's like New York, New York.
Right.
It's Atlantis, Atlantis. And in the city of Atlantis, it's huge. It's about the size of London, almost exactly the size of Greater London. And the inner London is about the same size of inner London as well. We show that in the book. It was done in concentric circles. There's a lot of engineering done. They put a great deal of influence on their gardens, and plants are very important. They have a racetrack. The temple is huge. It's just gigantic. It would be like the size of the Great Pyramid, that kind of size of a temple.
Wow.
And the biggest project was the canals that directed all the water from the mountains to the city. So it came into the city at a higher level and then sort of trickled through. So everybody had water. And even the concentric circles, there's islands, there's water between each of the concentric circles, and there's bridges that go over the water, and on the railings of the water, there's the bridges, there's water coming down. So there's ample supply of water. There may have even been some hot spring things like hot water as well. Mm-hmm. The actual culture he doesn't really get into very much, other than that they were extremely sophisticated as far as building is concerned.
That's interesting, because a lot of people tend to refer to it as some type of utopian society of the past, but you state that it is a monarchy, which doesn't sound very utopian to me. You know, the monarchies I'm familiar with seem pretty corrupt.
Well, yeah, I don't think that the influence, of course, goes back to Francis Bacon, the New Atlantis. He wrote this book called The New Atlantis, Francis Bacon in the time of Shakespeare. And in that, he sees it is a utopian society, Atlantis, and it probably somewhere beyond America is in that. So that started the whole sort of high tech element of and high scientists element. There's so much more written about Atlantis in fiction than there is in nonfiction. When it comes down to nonfiction, it really, you start with Plato, and then there's very little that's added to the story until the middle of the 17th century, when a German Jesuit priest, who in his time was as famous in the world as Albert Einstein was in the last century, his name was Athanasius Kircher. He was German born, but he lived most of his life in Rome. He was a Jesuit priest. And as you probably know, the Jesuits had armies of priests collecting things from around the world and sending them back to Rome, right?
Yeah.
And one of the things that he collected was a, which he claims to have come from Egypt, was a map of Atlantis. Now, this is the first real other piece of information that is other than Plato, that is, you know, separate from Plato. And this map, probably people have seen it. It's it looks as though he, when Kircher saw the map, he interpreted it as an island in the middle of the North Atlantic, because he said, according to the beliefs of the Egyptians and the description of Plato. So he's already locked into the Atlantic being simply to the west. And he maintained that the notion on the map, which was south, was up. So what we did is we took that map and just left it as it is, and then took a geophysical map, a globe rather, which shows what Antarctica looks like without its ice, and put it right up against it. And it's, and the comparison between what ice-free Antarctica looks like and this Atlantean map of Atlantis is startling. And that was really the main thing that really got me on this. This was back in 1976, if you can believe. And I was really, that's the thing that made me think, okay, there's something here more than just a story. It can't, how is it possible that a map published in 1665 can show Antarctica's position relative to South America, to Madagascar and South America, plus its island archipelago? All those things are in the map that we only learned of in the mid-1970s. So this map was like 300 years ahead of its time in terms of what Antarctica looked like, but it's labeled as a map of Atlantis.
Wow. Is that the Perry Reese map you're referring to?
No, that's the Kircher map.
The
Kircher map, yeah.
The Perry Reese map is a pretty famous ancient map. Some people refer to it as a hoax or think it couldn't have been as old as it is, but it is pretty unique. I mean, I'll let you talk about it. What's so unique about it? Does it relate to Atlantis at all?
Well, it does in this sense. First of all, it can't be a hoax because people have been referring to it. It was published in 1513. People know about it in 1513. You know, so it was around in 1513. The thing that's so amazing about Piri Reis was an admiral in the Turkish, the Ottoman Empire. He was a Turkish admiral. And he obtained some of the maps that Columbus had. They captured one of Columbus's ships, and before, normally what happens when you get captured, you think you're going to be captured, you throw your maps overboard, mm-hmm. but because geography is secret in that time. But they managed to capture his maps, and they got some other maps. And Piri Reis became a map maker, and he made this big map. It's quite a large map. It's about 2 by 3 feet on a deer skin, so it lasted a long time. Mm-hmm. And the thing that's amazing about it, and the thing that's it was lost to the world until 1929, when they were doing some renovations at the museum in Istanbul, and they came across it, and some scholars realized its significance because it showed South America all the way down to Antarctica accurately with longitude. Now, you have to bear in mind that Europeans weren't capable of determining longitude at sea until the 1770s. Yet this map in 1513 is accurately depicting points that are within a half a degree of their true positions. But the most startling aspect of it is that as you go down the map to the bottom, it starts to show parts of Antarctica that are beneath the ice. That is, they are showing what seismic surveys show us lies beneath the ice. So this map in 1513 depicts several elements of Antarctica beneath the ice. So what we believe is that when Atlantis was destroyed, the survivors were in ships. And the things that survives after many, many centuries is maps. One of the things that survives, plus the art of astronomy, of course, because mm-hmm. the sailors know astronomy. So astronomy and cartography are things that live on even after all the ships have been, broken up and sunk to the bottom of the sea. There's still people taking the maps that they had. Now, these maps depict the world of 12,000 years ago. They depict the world as it was in the time of Atlantis. And so what it's suggesting is that there was advanced geographic knowledge of the Earth's geography before the end of the last ice age, which is something that is so startlingly unacceptable to traditional views of history.
Yeah, that's what I love about it. I love when that kind of stuff just turns conventional knowledge on its head. I mean, do you think if we were to dig into the ice in Antarctica, we would find ruins of these massive structures?
Well, you have to. I do believe that in some parts of Antarctica, where the ice is not very thick, that there is possibilities of finding remnants of Atlantis. However, in the main area where we believe the city was, there's a lot of snowfall has fallen there in the past 12,000 years. And ice doesn't really preserve, it preserves fruit and vegetables, but it doesn't preserve cultures because ice is flowing in slow motion. It's like a river and it's very slow motion. So it tends, and the weight tends to grind everything down. So if you're looking for something in Antarctica as a remnant of Atlantis, you're going to have to look in areas where the snowfall wasn't as great, so that and there are areas of whole areas where this could be explored, or in what I call like the eddies. If you imagine if you look at a river and you have a rock in the river and the water goes around the rock, so on the downside of the river, things can be preserved in the eddies of the rock. Likewise, the mountains that are in Antarctica, where the snow is moving, that moves in and around these mountains, and in the eddies of that, there would be places where things could be preserved.
Man, that would be such a find. Well, let's talk about how it got to be that way, how it got to be on a place where Antarctica is now. I mean, take us back, 12,000 years ago. What was going on? I mean, because apparently this is obviously a habitable area. What did it move to the pole, or did the poles shift? How does this theory work?
Well, what we use is the theory of it's called Earth crust displacement. Now, if you think of the outer shell of the Earth, like imagine you have an orange and you peel off the peel, and then you reattach the peel. Okay, so now the peel, the orange part of the orange, if you like, or the peel, can move independent of the interior. And what we're talking about is the entire outer crust of the Earth being shifted some 30 degrees. And we're talking about not just the continents, but also the ocean basins. Mm-hmm. So don't think of this. People get confused with plate tectonics. Plate tectonics is the idea that the Earth is made up of a series of plates, which is true. We're not disputing plate tectonics, and that they are gradually, very, very gradually moving in relationship to each other. It takes millions of years before you can really see big differences. We're not talking about that. What we're talking about, what plate tectonics assumes is that below the crust, there's a mobile layer. It's called the asthenosphere. It means weak zone. And then below that is the mantle, and then there's other parts of the interior. But what Charles Hapgood did, and he did this in complete association with Albert Einstein over a period of 3 years in correspondence. The correspondence is over 200 pages long, and I've read it all. And Albert Einstein guided the research, and Hapgood undertook it. And in that, he came to believe that the entire outer shell of our Earth periodically displaces some as much as 30 degrees. So now if you want to take a look at what the word, let's like look at North America, for example, as it was before the displacement.
Okay.
At that time, the Earth's crust that was over the North Pole or the axis was in the Hudson Bay rather than the Arctic Ocean. So then you had, of course, the polar zone is all covering North America, most of North America. And that's why you had this big ice sheet on North America. That's why you've got the Great Lakes and all the remnants of the ice sheets that were there. So North America 12,000 years ago was kind of like Antarctica is today. It was uninhabitable for large part. Only the fringes like Southern California and the very bottom of like Florida and Texas and all that area. And even there, they're pretty cold, but when you get to New England, it's under ice. You get New York, the state of New York's completely under ice. Michigan's under ice. Almost all the area, if you're anywhere near a Great Lake today, then 12,000 years ago, you would have been under ice. Mm-hmm. So the thing that's strange about this, though, while New York and New England and all these other areas are under ice, up in Alaska, and across Alaska into Siberia, there isn't big ice sheets. There's people, I mean, there's animals up there living that are temperate zone adapted. They require large quantities of grass and open lands and stuff. And they are there and they're existing there. And they're at the time of Atlantis, Siberia was not cold as it is today. It was warm. It was temperate. Now, If you go from Siberia and they call that Beringia, the landmass that used to exist between Alaska and Siberia, it's now underwater. But 12,000 years ago, there was so much ice on North America and Antarctica and Greenland and Europe that the ocean level was much lower than it is today, and so you had a landmass that joined Alaska and Siberia and Beringia together. That was a continuous landmass that wasn't separated by water like it is today. If you go through exactly through the center of the Earth and pop out the other side, it's called the Antipodes, the opposite side of the Earth. Then you're in what's called Western Antarctica. That is the part of Antarctica that's closest to South America, and that's where the maps were showing. We're seeing maps showing parts of Antarctica without ice there. The Kirker map is showing that section doesn't have ice. And what we're saying is that just as Siberia and Beringia and Alaska was temperate during the last so-called ice age, so also was a third of Antarctica. And bear in mind, Antarctica is the size of North America. A third of Antarctica is temperate. Two-thirds is still polar, but one-third is temperate. And it has all these really favorable ocean currents that would make it warmer than the latitudes that it's at the time. Mm-hmm. So the Earth crust displacement theory is basically a movement of the entire outer shell of the Earth's crust that occurred some 11,500 years ago. And what it did is, at that time, North America left the polar zone and melted. You got the Great Lakes, the ocean level rose, and Antarctica as well. Everything is moving, including the entire shell is moving. It's not part or continents or anything. The entire thing is moving. So all of South America is moving south, and Antarctica, Atlantis, moves right into the polar zone. So from being a temperate zone island continent, it suddenly becomes ice encapsulated.
Man, that's super interesting. How does this coincide with stories of like the Great Flood, which most people assume is water melting from the global ice age. I mean, do you think rather than one ice age event, the reason various continents show they were once covered in ice is because these land masses just moved through the polar areas?
Well, the land masses are, remember, it's the crust that's moving. It's a, oh, that includes the ocean basins.
Right.
Yeah, so everything's moving. So what we think the flood is, first of all, there's tidal waves when you have a crustal displacement because major earthquakes, right? So you're getting tsunamis like you wouldn't see today. I mean, this is major. So you're getting floods through tsunamis that are almost continuous for a short period of time. Then, of course, once particularly North America is out of the polar zone, is in the temperate zone, there's a ferocious melt off, and the ocean and for 6,000 years the ocean rises. But in that first century, there's a really, really, really a lot happening in terms of the change of the ocean level. And there's extinctions happening at this time. And there's also other things happening that are very interesting, like the origins of agriculture. There's one particular site in Turkey that is extremely interesting, probably the oldest one in the world. We could talk about that later. But you were talking about the flood. And what we did on the study of the flood in Atlantis beneath the ice is we looked at all the stories of the flood that made mention of one of two things: either a change in the sky and somehow, because when the Earth's crust shifts, it seems as though the sky is falling. It's actually, of course, the crust moving, but it seems as though the sky is falling. Our first book was called When the Sky Fell. Mm-hmm. But so we found all around the world in different versions of the notion that the sky changes before the flood, that there's a change in the sun, where the sun rises and where it sets, or the stars seem to fall. All throughout the world, we find that the flood, the Great Flood, is associated with a traumatic change in the sky. The other thing that we found was that because we looked at all the myths of the flood that we could get our hands on, and I did this over a period of 2 years, and I was a librarian at the time, and so like I could get all the books, and I got all the books, and I read them all, and read all the stories of the floods that I could get my hands on. And out of that, we found like a half a dozen stories where that before the flood, there's mention of a lost island paradise. Now, this is really interesting because Plato's story, he's accused of inventing it. Mm-hmm. But when you put the Atlantis story into the larger framework of world mythology, and now you're looking at world mythology and you're saying, okay, flood, here's one of the things that's happened. Let me give you an example. In British Columbia, where I live, in the interior, in the Rocky Mountains, there's the Okanagan people. They also live in Washington State. Mm-hmm. And they have a story of having arrived in North America after having been catastrophically displaced from an island paradise in the middle of the ocean that's associated with whiteness. And they called it Suma Tui Wula. Okay. Hmm. That sound. Da 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 da. It's kind of like na 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 na.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Okay. Now let's go to Japan. And their oldest story is in the Kojiki, it's called. It's the story of ancient things. And in the very beginning of the creation of the world in the Japanese version of mythology, a god and a goddess stood over the earth, which was considered to be like a globe full of water, kind of gooey stuff, water, though not regular water. And they stick down a spear into that and twirl it around, and that's what's supposed to cause the earth to spin, right? And as they bring up the spear, droplets fall near the pole, and that is the Japanese islands. And they called it Onogoro-jima. Da 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 da.
Phonetically, it sounds similar.
Exactly. So now we go to ancient Iran. They have the Vedic literature that comes out of India, and there's one particularly, the oldest document in Iran, ancient Iran, is called the Zen Vesta. And in the Zen Vesta, they talk of an island in the ocean that is destroyed by a flood and a great blizzard that brings a dire winter on the original homeland, forcing the people to leave in big ships, taking with them the seeds of life and making their way to a new land. Now, the original land that they left was called Ariana Vajo. Da-da-da-da-da-da. Mm-hmm. So we have from Iran, Japan, and British Columbia, the same sound pattern referring to an island. Now, you've combined them all. It's a white island continent in the middle of the ocean, which is associated with whiteness and is now covered in snow and ice. That's Antarctica.
So, yeah.
So what we're saying is that even if Plato had not written down the account that was given to him by his ancestors, and we'd still be looking for a lost island paradise, whether it be called Eden or Sumatuiwula or Onagorojima or Ariana Vajo, we'd still be looking for a lost island paradise that existed before the flood.
Interesting. And
that's the common story. You see, it's very interesting when it comes to the peopling of America. When it comes to the peopling of America, what archaeologists have done is they've tried to paste on to the native North Americans, or we call them First Nations in Canada, paste on to them the European experience of, well, we left voluntarily, we came to this new land, and we explored it, and we conquered it. That's not the story that the First Nations say. The First Nations repeatedly say, we lived somewhere else, often it is reference to an island, which we were catastrophically displaced from, escaped in ships, and landed here. That's what they're saying in British Columbia. That's what they're saying among the Cherokee. That's what they're saying in Mexico. That's what they're saying in South America. So throughout the Americas, you get stories of people saying the reason that we arrived here was because we were catastrophically displaced from our homeland, which was destroyed during the Great Flood. That's what the First Nations are saying. That archaeologists give no credence to that whatsoever, and we do.
Yeah, wow, that's fascinating stuff, man. So this crust displacement, is this a fairly sudden thing? It must be, because it seems like we'd have to be generally stable, or we'd probably notice maybe astrological alignments being more off than they are. So is this like something that happens pretty rapidly?
I believe it does happen very rapidly. I think it's in a matter of weeks it's happened.
Weeks?
So, yeah, weeks. To be fair, Charles Hapgood, who I corresponded with and was my mentor, he believed it took 5,000 years for an Earth crust displacement to occur. So, I mean, I am very different from him, and the reason that I'm different from
him. Yeah, what do you base that on?
Okay, well, first of all, the abruptness of the changes that are occurring at 9,600 BC. First of all, before that time, we almost have no evidence of agriculture anywhere in the world. And then suddenly, it's in all the continents other than Australia. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're getting potatoes being domesticated in South America. You're getting maize being domesticated in Mexico. You're getting wheat and barley in the Middle East. You're getting rice in Asia, in several places, simultaneously, using different species of rice, but recreating the thing. My very first paper that I wrote about the whole theory of Earth crust displacement, it was published in the Anthropological Journal of Canada. It's in the appendix of both When the Sky Fell and Atlantis Beneath the Ice. Showed that there was a direct correlation between the emergence of agriculture, upon which all civilization is based, and the destruction that occurred with the last Earth crust displacement. We did, of course, in the scientific article, you couldn't get that published and say anything about Atlantis, so I didn't. I, at the time that I wrote it, I believe that Atlantis was this was the hidden hand behind the reemergence of agriculture. But you couldn't say that in an academic journal and get expected to be published. But it was published in the scientific literature, and it shows that, you know, at that time, abrupt changes occur from hunting and gathering, which have been going on for a million years, maybe?
Definitely. Wow.
Maybe at least 200,000 years of Homo sapiens. And then suddenly, wham, all around the world, there's these experiments with agriculture occurring in the very century that Zonkas told Solon Atlantis was destroyed. The other thing that happened at that time abruptly as well is there was massive extinctions. Mm-hmm. And those extinctions aren't equal all the way around the world. they were particularly pronounced in North America, Siberia, and South America. And the reason is, if you take a basketball in your hand and you've got it in your hand and you're so that your own palms are facing each other, and then you twist the ball so that the basketball so that the greatest change is happening around your nose, mm-hmm. you get that idea.
Yeah.
That line where there's the great amount of change goes right through North America, South America, comes back to Asia through Siberia and there. That's where the massive extinctions were. Now, if you're near where your palms are, like which happen to be like the Congo and South Pacific, then there's hardly any extinctions at all, because the changes in latitude. You're tropical and you remain tropical, or you're temperate and you remain temperate.
Yeah,
it's places that are going from polar to temperate, or temperate to tropical, or tropical to temperate, or temperate to polar, where there's a lot of deaths, and that's what's happening, and that's happening very rapidly around 9600 BC. So I think that it's another indication that things are happening rapidly.
That's interesting. So how does this tie into at all? Like, it's kind of similar to the 2012 prophecy, people talking about a pole shift. I mean, how often does this happen? Is this something that we're due for?
Well, we believe it happens every 41,000 years, and it's been 12,500 years. So we got another nearly 30,000 years before it happens again. And it may not happen again at all, because one of the factors that contributes to it, maybe not the key factor, but might be the buildup of ice sheets, you see, and global warming is preventing the buildup of ice sheets, which is the normal state of affairs on the planet. So the next time we come around and the circumstances occur where the Earth's tilt is at a maximum, and there's maybe a solar flare from the sun, an electromagnetic storm hits the Earth at the pole and goes down into the center of the Earth and heats it up. This is a theory developed by a guy named Friedman in Florida as a cause for the Earth crust displacement. Then the whole asthenosphere, which is the layer right below the crust, gets liquefied. Normally it's like tar, but if it gets heated, it turns into like lava. And that allows the Earth's crust to shift. So that's what we think happens, that it may very well happen very abruptly. We don't believe we're due for a long time.
Okay. How much traction has this theory really gotten? Because, I mean, even with conventional theories of the Earth's ancient past, we're still left with some inconsistencies and unsolved problems. I mean, do you think Earth crust displacement theory would provide a more logical answer for some of those problems?
Well, yes. I mean, I think that what we showed with the origins of agriculture was that, for example, let's take tropical, the origins of tropical agriculture, because that's really simple. There is a place in South America, incidentally, before the last displacement, most of South America was in the Northern Hemisphere. because the crust was in a different position relative to the Earth's axis. Then, okay, so there is an area, so the change was about 2,000 miles, say. It's approximately 2,000 miles.
Okay.
There's a spot where in the near that was 1,000 miles north of the equator, and after this displacement, it ended up 1,000 south of the equator. So you can imagine, you can see that a place that had that retained its relationship to the equator as being exactly the same, just moving hemispheres, that is Lake Titicaca, where the great a lot of big pyramids there. That's potatoes were first domesticated. So the Earth crust displacement pinpoints the Lake Titicaca area as an area of ecological reserve, if you like, during the displacement, because the climate didn't change a lot. If you go right straight through the middle of the Earth from Lake Titicaca and hit the center of the Earth and then come out, pop out on the other side, you end up in Thailand. And that's where rice was domesticated around this time as well. And there's other areas that are midway between the two equators as well, like in Ethiopia, at the headwaters of the Blue Nile. That's where millet was domesticated. Mm-hmm. So, and then when you turn to the big area we're now looking at the area that had been tropical and went temperate. And it adjoined an area that was temperate. So all the plants and animals that were adapted to living in the temperate zone that survived because it was still temperate after, now had a whole new area that they could move into that was newly temperate, which had formerly been tropical. And this area, which extends from Egypt through the Middle East, through India, right to China, is where the first five civilizations that we know about occur. And that's where all the agricultural origins are. The vast majority of agricultural origins on our planet occur in this one crescent that goes from Egypt through Crete, through the Middle East, into India, into China. And so the Earth crust displacement theory organizes the origins of agriculture on a global scale, both at temperate and tropical.
This is very convincing stuff, man. Oh, go on.
So that's just one unsolved problem.
Uh-huh.
Of agriculture. Let's look at the more the longer unsolved problem is the ice ages. Now, we tend to think, and all the research into the origins of the ice ages is still based upon a false fixation, which was that it was overall global temperatures dropping. We can falsify that very easily because we know that during a time when New England was under ice, Siberia was warmer. So if the Earth's crust hadn't shifted and temperatures were dropping, why is Siberia having animals and humans and people living there and temperate animals living there, and while New England is under ice? So what we're saying is ice ages are always with us. Really, if you live in a polar zone, if you're in Antarctica, you're in an ice age.
Yeah.
If you're in the Arctic Circle, you're in an ice age. And just that the crust moves through these polar zones, in and out of these polar zones, and as it moves into them, creates ice sheets. As it moves out, it melts off. And what we can explain the glaciation patterns in North America, Europe, and Asia for the past 100,000 years through three Earth crust displacements during that time. No other theory exists that is capable of explaining simultaneously why there was ice sheets in British Columbia, ice sheets in Quebec and Ontario, and Europe, but not Siberia. Ours can. So because we really say there's always an ice age. It's just if you're in the polar zone or not.
Yeah, it makes sense to me, man. But let's look at the more conventional views of where the discoveries of Atlantis might have been. I mean, some people are saying that they're finding these ruins beneath sea level near Spain or off the coast of Cuba. Those are the two areas I hear talked about most. I mean, what do you think those are? Are they just other cities destroyed by this displacement shift?
Well, here's the thing. If you're talking about Atlantis, you have to go to Plato. And then when you go to Plato, you're ultimately going to Solon, the conversation between Zonkas and Solon. Everything else is speculation. This is the only thing that exists. And Zonkas makes it absolutely clear that it's an island continent. It's the size of Libya and Asia combined, is what he said, which is the size of North Africa and the Middle East combined. In other words, it's bigger than the North Atlantic Ocean, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, huge.
It's an island continent. How can it be Spain or someplace like that? It's
true.
Just, it's got to be, it's too big not to fit the story. So what they almost always do, and all of these theories that talk about it, is they say, oh, this is an exaggeration, that it wasn't really 9,000 years ago, it was 900 years ago, or the size is magnified by 1,000% or something. So what they have to do is they have to distort what Zonkas told Solon in order to have their theories fit. We don't have to do that with Antarctica. Antarctica is an island continent in the middle of the real ocean. There's no distortion there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That makes sense. I mean, so I guess these are just other little cities, because I assume with such a radical change, there probably would be tons of anything on the coast would be destroyed, I assume.
Absolutely. Yeah. In the story that Zonkas tells Solon, he does mention that there are gives notion that there were colonies outside of Atlantis, the idea that there was other places. Now, all of those would have been at the sea level at the time of Atlantis, which was, oh, it's about 100 meters difference between today. Today, the ocean is 100 meters higher than it was at the time of Atlantis, because all the ice that was on the sheet on North America, Greenland, and all these other places had melted. Not Greenland, but it hasn't melted there. But so you have, when Atlantis was destroyed, all the ports at that time that were at sea level, ultimately within a century, were gone.
Yeah.
And within 6,000 years, there's no remnants. So what you have, you find things under the water that are remnants of these colonies, possibly. And those can show up just about anywhere, whether it be the Caribbean or off of South America or off of California, or it could show up anywhere because they had colonies around the world.
Yeah. Now, has anyone really looked into this? Like, has anyone done any expeditions? I mean, I know the Nazis seem to have a fascination with the poles. Do you think they were onto this idea at all?
Well, not really, because like they were fixated on the Arctic as opposed to the Antarctic. Although they did send expeditions to Antarctica, there's no doubt about that, and they were going to make some claims on Antarctica. Their fixation was largely about a place called Thule, and it was supposedly an island in the Arctic Ocean. But, you know, you can't say that they weren't interested in Antarctica, but they really believed that Atlantis was in the Arctic Ocean. And so Antarctica was just a bonus area for them to check out, but it wasn't their primary focus, let's put it that way.
Okay. Let's talk about Göbekli Tepe. I know that you've drawn some relationship between that and Atlantis, correct?
Yeah, here's the thing. Göbekli Tepe is a site in Turkey near the Syrian border. It dates to the very century that Zonkas said Atlantis was destroyed, 9,600 BC.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that's interesting, it's a huge site. Only 10% of it has been excavated. But what they have found in these oldest structures, they're sort of like, it's kind of like a Stonehenge type thing. They're these 18-ton T-shaped blocks of stone, solid blocks of stone, that are in circles, and there's a series of them. And the oldest ones are date to the time of the destruction of Atlantis. And as time goes by, as like, you know, a century goes or two centuries, three centuries, they continue to build there, but they aren't capable of building as well as the first ones. And that seems to be, to me, to be a remnant of the Atlantean engineering capacities so well documented in Plato. They had all these engineering capacities. So this thing that's so strange about Göbekli Tepe is that here you have a place where everybody in all our official archaeology says it's all hunting and grounding, hunting and gathering throughout the world. There's no civilization until, say, 6000 BC. Suddenly, this thing is a civilization at the same century that Atlantis was destroyed. So we just moved the beginning of civilization from what they say in Malta may have been the first one, you know, before Egypt, and the oldest one would be like 6,000 years ago. This is nearly 12,000 years. So the clock on the origins of agriculture by the discovery of Göbekli Tepe goes right back to twice as long as we thought it was. So what we thought civilization began 6,000 years ago, it's more like 11,500 years ago civilization began. And it began at Göbekli Tepe. And within 100 mile diameter of where Göbekli Tepe is, you have all these origins of agriculture sites, very old, also dating to the same century as Atlantis. There's one in Syria that's just less 40-50 miles from Göbekli Tepe, that it has wheat, barley, rabbits, goats, pigs, being domesticated for the very first time. And it's so what the German archaeologist who is in charge of the Göbekli Tepe, he's come up with a theory of what was happening there, and he calls it a temple, and that the temple inspired people to go to agriculture. We think that what it really is, this is survivors from Atlantis in boats to have the engineering capacity to create megalithic structures, and also know that they need to get agriculture boosted, rebooted. And that's what's happening at Göbekli Tepe. They're creating a megalithic structure that will draw people, hunters and gatherers, to them, and then they're directing the hunters and gatherers how to do agriculture so that they can sustain it. So they're trying to reboot civilization. It ultimately failed, but it was an attempt, and it was the earliest evidence of what we call civilization in the world. Because normally, for civilization to be any culture to be called a civilization, you have to have agriculture or permanent buildings and writing. You could have two or three of those, and it's still called a civilization. But without, and they had permanent buildings, very sophisticated, and there's absolutely no evidence of the learning curve. Like, they don't start to build these little stump-size T-shaped stones.
Yeah, they just go for it.
By yourself, and then work their way up to these 18-ton ones. No, they start with the 18-ton ones, and then through time, they diminish down to the little ones.
Right. So that suggests prior knowledge.
It does. And there's no evidence whatsoever anywhere in the world of that kind of ability to do that kind of masonry that exists at Göbekli Tepe, except for one story that exists that at that very time when that was being built, an advanced civilization was destroyed called Atlantis.
Wow. That is a fascinating thread. Very solid case, man. It's shocking how little we know about the past. It's either been lost or kept secret or rewritten or manipulated. Man, you know, this has been a fascinating chat. I mean, it really makes you wonder. I really appreciate you coming here. The hour just flew by. What would you like to tell the people a little bit more about your books and where they can get them or anything else that you're working on?
Oh, sure. The current book is Atlantis Beneath the Ice. You can get that in just about any bookstore or Amazon or whatever you can. So there's also an ebook of it. The book that I wrote before that was Atlanta's Blueprint with Colin Wilson. Colin Wilson just died last month. This is one of his best-selling books. He's written over 100 books. He wrote over 100 books. And the Atlantis Blueprint is really about more about the megalithic structures around the world and how they fit into a global pattern that can be interpreted by understanding Earth crust displacement. It's a little bit complicated to get quickly into, but that's what that's about. Mm-hmm. And then the very first book that we wrote was When the Sky Fell, of which Atlantis Beneath the Ice is a new, a revised and expanded edition of.
Very cool. Mm-hmm. All right, man. Well, thanks again. I really appreciate it. You really got my brain going.
Okay, good.
All right, man. Enjoy the day.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Wow, people. There it is. Rand Flemoth and the Earth Crust Displacement Theory. What if, guys? What fucking if? I love it. So that's it for me this week. Please review the show, and thanks for listening. I'd appreciate a donation into the Money Bomb. It's already at $370, so I'm going to have to be giving away a lot of money in this one if we keep this pace. And again, if you purchase anything from Amazon, please go through the portal on thehiresidechats.com, and we'll get a commission off that. We also have a fan-made subreddit now. So if you like Reddit, if you have any guest requests or ideas for the show, please check that out. I look at it every day, so your voice will be heard. It's just /HiresideChats. All right, I'm fucking out. Your move, Earth Crust.
When the ship runs out of ocean and the vessel runs aground, lands where we know the boat is found. Now there's nothing unexpected but the water giving out. Land's not a word we have to shout, but there's something beside the shoreline. Moving across the beachhead, coming up from the shipwreck, making as if to say, women and men. Women and men across the ocean, they now begin to pour out from the boat and up the shore. Two by two they enter the jungle, and soon they number more. Three by three as well as four by four. Soon the stream of people gets wider, then it becomes a river. River becomes an ocean.